month ago, I moderated a panel, a fascinating panel, with the Morgan School of Architecture and Planning and the Friends of Architecture at Morgan, exploring design as social practice, which really means looking at all the nuances we never talk about. We just think of architecture as buildings going up, but it's more than that. It's how design affects us, how we affect design, and how special relations affects issues like race and age and more. Exploring the topic with me is Morris Cox from Tulane University in New Orleans, Yolanda Daniels from Studio Sumo in New York City, and Gina Pallara of the FDR Four Freedoms Park in New York. I know you'll enjoy.
This is a very critical question. I think about it because we're sitting here at Morgan State University in a school of architecture that is dedicated to working in urban America. And whenever we think about building things in cities, things are always built for somebody, for some community, because there's a piece of real estate to be had, or and something is built up for it, whatever group wants to make money and build it up. But what doesn't often happen is communities have very little say in what their communities look like and how we develop them and how we design with people what they want to live in. And it's like for most of humanity, people constructed their own places with their own hands. And now not only are things constructed for people, but are constructed often without people. The idea of how you build something. So I'm just curious how you begin to start a conversation that changes the very nature of how we think about what we design for. We talked about Thomas Jefferson's quote that you started with, and I can also think as architect, as agitator, not just political, somebody to recreate the kind of change. And since you gave us a quote first, why don't we start?
Again, thank you for this occasion to come into your spanking new building. It still smells of new building, and I see you are starting to really fill it out. And so it's wonderful to be in this space, to be on the stage with my colleagues here, and spend this evening with you. Everything you just mentioned kind of resonates with my daily activity in New Orleans, where I work, I direct a design center that works exclusively with nonprofits, neighborhoods, those who traditionally don't have access to the design resources that designers, planners, landscape architects have. And so we have created a structure by which we've given the agency of identifying problems, design problems that people are struggling with to those communities. We conduct an annual requests for proposals and put it out to nonprofits, and the nonprofits identify the design needs. I give you that piece of background because currently we are working with a community in the Lower Ninth Ward, and I'm sure many of you have heard about the struggle of that particular part of New Orleans to come back. Last year, a neighborhood association proposed to us to come up with a community-driven plan for a 14-acre site, a historic site in their neighborhood, in response to a developer who, in this historic neighborhood of bungalows and two-story buildings, wanted to put a nine-story towers overlooking the river. And to make it worse, the developer was a well-known architect in town getting into this practice of development. And so our charge was to work with a community, allow them to drive the process, and not to lead out front, but to lead by the side. And the community took this project to a place. It was a very intense process that engaged over 120 residents. And they came up with a set of priorities, which have effectively changed the course of this project. There was a planning commission meeting two nights ago where they showed up with about 40 people in the New Orleans tradition of coming into a planning commission meeting. It was a second line with musicians leading the way. I've never seen anything like this in my life. And they completely, because of their understanding of the design issues in their community, having been a part of this process, completely stymied the planning commission, who could not, after 3 hours of public testimony, could not come to a decision. And so I look at that as an example of a community taking control. They had to acquire the skills. They had to trust designers to help them understand the complexities of development, of historic preservation, of landscape, and of architecture. But once they had those tools, they could be the advocates that we look for when we talk about working with informed clients. Once again, they had to pit themselves against a professional developer that had all of the expertise, who could access the political structure of the city, and then there was the neighborhood. So the only way that they were able to find their way out of it was to come to a design resource. It suggests a lot of different things, but I think it sets in my mind an example of what the value that designers can play at the service of a community that's trying to drive community design process.
So why don't the panelists kind of grab this as well, and then we'll kind of pick some things you all have said and kind of delve a little deeper.
Well, I guess what comes to my mind is an experience that I'm going through right now as well, which is that I'm working on a commission. I think I am. I'm never quite sure, actually. We haven't signed the contract, but it's part of an RFP that was from the City of New York. It was a very kind of creative RFP through their Economic Development Corporation, which is a kind of privatized end of development in the city, for an area in Brownsville, which is in Brooklyn, and it's been resistant to development. Not that the city hasn't tried. And so they came up with this program of pop-up designs, kind of small designs that would be anything from small retail installations to bookmobiles to clinics. And it was kind of open for teams to come in. Every team had to have a community member. Teams to come in and write what the program would be. So in the end, what happened was the community, the teams had to be driven by the community members. The communities kind of invented the programs that they needed. The team that we're working with, they are doing a cultural center. It's in a kind of art center, but they're coupling with some retail, small retail businesses in the community, kind of coming together to make this cultural space, which is dance, performance art, and then things like cupcakes and sneakers, because those are some of the local businesses that they partnered with. So for me, it's been really interesting working on this team, where my company was brought in through the community organization, and the city's organization, the EDC, holds the purse strings. And there's this kind of tug and war between the two. And in a way, I feel like I'm a bit on the sidelines watching it. Our client is the community organization, but in a way, the city organization is the one that we all have to answer to. And so part of the project is top-down, and part of it is bottom-up. And it's just been a lot of negotiation for all of us, and it's a really interesting process. I'm not really sure what it's going to lead to for the community. I think the city would like that these small programs are kind of like catalysts for change in the area, but in the way that big developers would come in and see that it's worth developing and then take over. The community groups, they all hope for change as well, but in a totally different way. And so it's just a very, very volatile, interesting process to be engaged in.
It's interesting to hear about both of your experiences. It heartens me to know that there is still the possibility that community groups can come in and make a big change. I've been working with a group of people, residents, and other stakeholders down in the South Street Seaport area of New York City. The EDC, which is essentially the landlord for that area, has in some sense been an absent landlord. And what the plan now is that's on the table is to essentially give away to a Texas-based developer what is the oldest part of New York City and the reason why it rose to its preeminence as an international port. and allow this developer to come in and build a 50-story tower right next to Pier 17, which is very close to the Brooklyn Bridge. You know, to hear about your struggles with the EDC, it's, I think, in terms of policy, there are moments for community members to get involved, but to speak to what you were saying, Maurice, often the community members don't understand what is a very opaque process, particularly in New York. Frankly, all of my elected officials don't even understand the process. Having built this major piece on the south point of Roosevelt Island and trying to deal with the jurisdictional complexities of that, I mean, to the point where you can't even answer the question, who owns the land? You know, it's just layers and layers and layers of bureaucracy. And there are moments in the process, which is supposed to be a public process, for instance, at the South Street Seaport, when there's a disposition of city property, there's supposed to be community involvement, and it's supposed to be a public process. But what happens is no one understands the public process. They don't understand the time frame. So the milestones pass, and no one knows about it until it's too late. So there is an opportunity for community involvement, but you do need to have someone there who can educate you about what it is. And there is this sort of top-down, like, forcing people to accept a development that isn't what anybody in the community wants, isn't what is a responsible stewardship of really irreplaceable city property, to just hand it over to a private developer without any give back to the community whatsoever. And unfortunately, I really think that the hallmark of the last 12 years of New York City's administration has been a very heavy developer presence without much community involvement and without any real serious planning about how are we going to sustain these dense developments without the infrastructure. Because no one, you know, they'll say, oh, build a tower for 70,000 people, but they don't build the schools that are necessary. We don't have the electricity grid. So there's a way in which the communities really, really begin to suffer because there's such a pressure on the existing infrastructure to accept this incredible density. And I think there are some communities that have successfully fought back, and I would certainly hope that the project that you're working out in Bronzeville will help to educate. But I think what's been surprising to me most about the practice of architecture is the degree to which education is so central to what we do in educating your client, educating your contractors, educating your colleagues. It's a constant, constant, ongoing educational process.
I agree. I think in essence, when you're talking about community engagement, you're actually talking about community education. You're giving them a safe place to get brought up to speed about the complexities of how you might actually impact a project or deliver a project. And I'm not quite sure where you learn that in school, that you have a responsibility to not only just serve your client, but actually often to kind of cajole them out of a status quo, out of a complacency, out of a reactive mode. And if you're asking them to become advocates for the quality of a physical environment, there's some new learning that has to happen. And we inevitably, we are the ones that have to do it. And we have to do it in a public forum, which is very, very different than serving a private client or a board of directors. It happens in the public arena. And the irony of the public arena is that not everybody went obtained the same level of education. So you have to educate across different levels of where people are. And it's kind of a messy, messy process. So either you have developed a tolerance for disorder and messiness and things not coming in a nice, fine package, or you won't have an impact in that arena. It's easy for me to extend my charge as an educator to educate more than my students. I mean, I take it our job is to educate the society in general, that we form a social contract of sorts when we decide to go into the design disciplines. And I think the challenge is, while it's a social practice, we work within a market, private, privately driven, you know, system, economy, which puts a developer against the community in which they are trying to possibly locate a new project. So I think that really, for me, is the kind of big challenge. How do you advance democratic practices that support the public's interests in an economy which is driven 90% by private investment within a public context?
Well, I mean, it's part of it, jump right in, Gina, but it's part of it the idea that how you democratize design, the idea of design. I mean, when you look at Baltimore, I mean, you all haven't seen a lot of Baltimore, but many cities are similar. You look through Baltimore City and we have these giant swaths of vacant land, torn down houses, blocks where people live in their homes next to homes that are just desolate and destroyed in row houses in Baltimore. And you can look at that in one of a couple of ways. You can look at that and go, I'm a developer. I can tear these things down and I can build a high rise and bring people with lots of money in here. They can look at the water and we can build our city that way. Or you can look at it, and or you can look at it as how you democratize design with places like this and communities to really think about what they want their place to look like and have that on the table. It is education, but there are a lot of brilliant minds with no degrees living in working class communities who have ideas about what things should look like, who know how to build the inside of a house anyway. They do it all the time. Who fix grandma's kitchen up and build it from nowhere. Those skills are there. The ideas are there. So how do you think you begin that? How does that happen? I mean, you know, how do we begin to do that? And I'll leave it there. I have other things that specifically come out of some of your work that I want to kind of probe, but let me leave it there. I mean, how do you do that?
It's a process of education, I believe. It's education on so many different levels. It's educating not just the people who live there, but educating your elected officials, educating everybody that gets involved in the entire process. And I think maybe that explains why so many architects also teach, is because essentially I think the practice of architecture is so central, the education is so central to the practice of architecture, and that it is only through that that you can begin to elevate what people's expectations are of their city, of the city's responsibility towards their communities, and that it's not just about giving the city away to the deepest pockets and the people who have the most money, but to really try to build a community. And I think that always has to start fundamentally with education.
But I also think it has to do with being there. Being there, because it seems that something that comes to mind is thinking about education. When I was younger, I was in architecture school, and my church asked me to do, like, something. And I went there with my T-square and my triangle, because I was studying to be an architect, and that's how you did architecture. And they just thought I was really, you know, cute. and, you know, because, you know, like, say if my father had gone there, he wouldn't have had a T-square and a triangle. He would have just gone and, like, you know, talked to the people and figured out what needed to be done. Well, I talked to them and figured out what needed to be done, but I came with those tools as well. And I think, so, like, just being there and facilitating the conversation, but just allowing, kind of getting at the same level as your audience, as the people that you're trying to engage. And so in some ways it's easier if you leave the T-square and the triangle, the computer, if you don't have those things, and just kind of come on equal terms and then just, you know, listen. I think people do have valid ideas about how to repair or fix or imagine their communities. And I think tools vary. The tools can be simple building blocks that you can develop together, and maybe new languages are formed in the process.
It definitely reminds me of my transition back to the United States after living abroad for 10 years. in Italy, of all places. But when I came back, where architecture in Italy is pretty important. People go to architecture school as a liberal arts education. So lots of thousands and thousands of architects. So held in very high regard. Then I come back to the United States, and I locate in Charlottesville, Virginia, where the University of Virginia is. And I proceeded to be the architect, to speak publicly and advocate. And I was totally dismissed. I was actually shocked that my opinion didn't matter any more than the shop owner down the street when it came to the built environment. And so I had to figure this out because I thought design was important, and I thought it was important that I use the knowledge I had and share it with the community. So I founded a neighborhood association. I became the president of my neighborhood association. And just like that, I had instant respect. I was listened to by my political leaders because they knew that when I spoke, I had a few hundred households behind me. So I wasn't just speaking for myself. I wasn't speaking for my profession. I was speaking for my community. And so in a way, it's this issue about being there. I mean, if you want to be of service to your community, you actually kind of have to live in the community that you hope to serve. That's a very simple starting point. So you say, how did you enter politics? Well, I entered politics by volunteering to be the president of my neighborhood association. And that allowed me to have the kind of dialogue that you're talking about. And it wasn't so much as an architect. It was just as a citizen, as a resident, who happened to have an additional set of skills, just the way any other discipline would have a set of skills to bring to the conversation. So I think that's really, really key. And I think it's a really hard thing for us to teach, because we're talking about, teaching citizenship, basically, right? How do you not simply identify yourself by your profession, but by your allegiance to the community in which you live? How I have attempted to do it is to invite my students to be a part of the communities that I have become a part of. So if it's the Lower Ninth Ward and people are trying to figure out how to come back home, I invite my students to be a part of that community and to listen and learn what it means to just desperately want to be back in a place that has been decimated, and learn to listen to that. Or currently, we're trying out a new curriculum at Tulane University, which is a social engagement studio. It's in the core of the curriculum. And our clients are the Mardi Gras Indians. I don't know if many of you know of the Mardi Gras Indians. They are African-American tribes that dress in beads and feathers and rhinestones. They sew these elaborate suits. Google them. You will be amazed. They come out three nights a year. They spend thousands of dollars on these costumes. And they're a bit of a secret society. We are partnering with them. So our second year students interview them, engage them, and have to define out how do you take this street-based culture and begin to create institutions. So they have to speak to people who are not necessarily from their background. I mean, they are very, talk about other, and I think that issue of trying to put students in context where they're somewhat uncomfortable, this applies. But my notion is the engagement or the desire to be a citizen, the desire to begin to respect people who have other kinds of knowledge, kind of begins in studio. And it's the exact opposite model that architecture has created for itself, where we pretend to create, recreate the world in this building, when in reality, the kind of interference and friction you get when you allow these voices that you can't quite control into your design process, that's really where I think the learning kind of happens.
And Yolanda, that feeds in some ways right into some of the stuff that I know that you've been working on over the years that I think is fascinating, because we always hear that there is no black architecture. Two things are antithetical. They don't exist in the same world. I mean, that's a popular notion among a lot of people. But you've tackled the subject of race in architecture and gender in architecture, really, and think about how to think differently and what that means. From what you were saying, Maurice, I'm going to probe that and pull that into this conversation.
I see what I've been doing is kind of uncovering stories that are there. They're there, but they're just not recognized. Like when it comes to, I guess, occupancy, one of the things I've been looking at kind of recently is just different states of occupancy. And I think it kind of goes around the question of, or not the question, but the idea of like housing as a human right. When one looks at different states of occupancy outside of the comfort of your home, there's homelessness, there's states of appropriated occupancy. What do people do when they can't, you know, afford housing, when they can't kind of take part in the housing market? And I've looked at this in the United States and then also kind of globally. And looking at it globally actually teaches you about what's happening in this country. Which is really important. But I think all of the research that I've done on states of occupancy has really just gotten me to the point where the question of housing as a human right, like housing as something that is not really about the market, but it's actually something that humans need to survive. Basically, without housing, we can't really survive. I guess, like, in the work that I've been doing where I say it's about things that are not really visible, because of the market, we don't really see that as a viable, visible, tangible kind of right. And it's a conversation that I think people are starting to have now. Another kind of form of research that I've been doing has been looking at stories. When one looks at African Americans in architecture or dwellings in the past, we've had the problem that often the spaces that African Americans have dwelled in have been of non-durable materials. And so there's the impression that there is no history because the materials didn't, there's no kind of like material fact that you can go and grab onto. And that's not exactly true. There are facts and stories that you can find, but they're just more difficult. So one of the projects that I was involved in, and this was in, I think it was maybe, what is it, William Williams from UVA, who's now in Cincinnati, and also I think another David, who was at Rice.
David Brown,
yeah, they kind of put together a series of shows. One was on row houses in Texas, in Houston, and the other was a project that looked at sites along the Amtrak migration route from north to south. It was called the Southern Crescent Line. And basically, when we were looking at the Southern Crescent Line, I was looking at segregation, but I was also looking at the role of the train and divisions between public and private, and how you could track the history of segregation through the different states along this train line.
We have to take a very brief break, but we'll have more on this conversation on design and social practice in just a minute. Stay with us. Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I was part of a conversation hosted by the Friends of Architecture at Morgan University and the Morgan School of Architecture and Planning about design and social practice, and here's more of that conversation.
The way that I kind of came to tell this story was by looking at laws. So laws that had to do with public accommodations. And that's something that's tangible that you can actually look at, and it tells you a lot about the development of cities. And it also tells you about how people occupied spaces in cities. So when one looks at laws of public accommodation, one sees laws that have restrictions or non-restrictions, whatever, on transportation, but also on spaces of education. It kind of goes from the train all the way to the home. So laws that kind of either restricted or allowed passage in certain places were passed in different states over time. And one can track them, and you get a very good picture of what it was like to travel, but also what it was like to live in different states and different cities, and the impact on not just the African American community, but on communities as a whole. In looking at the train and segregation on the train, what was interesting for me was finding where people broke the law. And the way you could tell when laws were broke was if a law was passed that didn't allow for segregation in XYZ place, like train stations were not like part of it, but restaurants, hotels, maybe, I don't know, like clinics. So that might have been one law that was passed. And then a law that might have been passed after that covered those spaces, but then other spaces that were almost like, you know, in the same type. And you could tell that the first law didn't cover enough spaces, so another law had to be passed that covered more spaces so that, you know, they would like get the people who were breaking the law. And then another way you could tell that laws were broke was by the fines. So the fines were against specific groups. When it came to like train travel, some states had laws that were against the conductors. So if the conductor broke the law by letting someone sit in a part of a train that they weren't supposed to sit in, like an African American sitting in a white car, the conductor would be fined as well as the person who was fined. So you could tell just by looking at that that conductors broke the law. In other states, you could see for miscegenation. And so I actually tracked all the way to the House, and with miscegenation, the penalty might be against the minister who conducted the ceremony, the white person who got married, and the African American would just be put in jail. But you know, there would be fines for all of the people who were doing wrong, and then that way you could tell who the wrongdoers were. And what I called sweeping laws were the national laws, and those were the laws that just in their language included every condition that you could think of, so there was no question of anybody breaking the law. And in this case, it was toward integration, not segregation.
And bringing that all back around to where we are, I keep thinking about the idea about democratizing design. All the things that, you know, we're sitting here at university with young people who are going to end up in some level of work in this world of design and figuring out what structures look like and working in neighborhoods and building things and dreaming of what things could be. So what we have to do is take into account not just the individual genius and thought about what design should look like, what is in me I want to create, which is in all of us here, right? You have something inside, you see it, and you want to put it together, you want it there. But there's all these other pieces that, if we're in a place like this, we can begin to plug into that and think about. And that it has to do with race, it has to do with class, has to do with the democratization of design, it has to do with the environment, it has to do with where, you know, I don't know what level LEEDS building this is, but some level it is, I'm sure. Gold, excuse me. I'm not surprised. Gold. So at that point, at this point, right, you know, in our society, a lot of that is unattainable for many people because it's so expensive to do. And that's another process that has to happen in terms of the democratization of being able to live and build and create places and environments that are whole with the environment, given where we're going. So that's that in some ways is like starting a dynamic in a curriculum in our school of architecture and design that is pretty revolutionary. Because, as you said, Maurice, you came back to America, architects weren't taken seriously. And this is a process made for the 20th century of a remix of what can happen, what can happen. So what are your thoughts about that? How do you mix that up and start making that happen? What does it look like? You're designing this place. What does it look like?
A willingness to ask difficult questions and to see the architect as someone who is an instigator. Architects usually have a reputation in communities of being the loudmouth, you know, the ones that will dare speak unspeakable things about the injustices that they might see, whether they be economic, spatial injustices. And I think of that as like finding your voice. Generally, when you speak in public, you kind of have to do some research. You have to prepare yourself. And so I think that the notion that you're entering into a public profession that requires you to find your voice and to use it, I think, is kind of key. And I think education in general does that for you, as it gives you more and more confidence. So I think that's one place to start. I think as I listen to the inequities that we're talking about, or the racialization of space that you were describing with along the train, and the ways in which laws participate in the creation of this environment. And I think of every building that gets built is regulated, whether it's setbacks, whether it's build-outs, whether it's floor area ratios. It all starts with laws and zoning, things that are allowed to be mixed and things that are forced to be separated, which infect how a community might develop. And then I was thinking about, just because just yesterday the governor of Arizona vetoed this law that right. You all know, that would have formalized discrimination against people's sexual orientation, would have been reason for businesses to discriminate. And I think, wow, I mean, we're talking about the 1950s and 60s. Here you are talking about the 2000s, and we're talking about the same set of issues, just a different group of people. So there is tons to be radicalized about. There's tons to connect to that has an implication for the built environment. I think about this issue about being able to discriminate against someone on their job, or where they might dine, or where they might live. It's all spatial. I mean, it's all spatial. It's all social. So I think it's a part of the menu of concerns that we would naturally want to have to speak to. So I don't know. It returns to this issue about being engaged. This is a discipline, even though we love to make things, and it's very tactile. And I think many of us didn't get into it necessarily because we understood it as a big social platform. Some of us just like to build things, and so. But then, just as you start to learn the kind of economic underpinnings that dictate what we do, you also start to understand the social implications of what you do, and it forces your practice to become public. It forces your practice, despite the market. It forces your practice to take on other issues. And I think about I think about the firms here. And this came to me just recently. Alan Eskew of Eskew Dumas Ripple, which is a renowned firm in the Southeast, recently passed. At the same time that his firm was voted the AIA Firm of the Year. They were talking to us a little bit how they built their case. It wasn't so much just because they do extraordinarily beautiful contemporary architecture. It was that they had built a culture in their firm, an expectation that every person in their firm would serve a public purpose. So they either had to start something, they started like the Young Women in Architecture, or they started the, a minority pipeline for high school students, or they served on the Planning Commission or they served on the a task force. They actually did a chart and realized that the principals of that firm set a standard that they would be engaged, and everyone found their place. And it became a culture. And they actually believe that that's one of the main reasons why they got the Firm of the Year, because they were able to take a practice and create a culture. So I think that it's not just in the schools. It can happen just by the way in which principals conduct their work and the message they send to their employees.
I would agree with that, and I think it is a matter of creating a culture. And I think the culture can be in an educational institution, it can be in an architectural firm, it can be. But I think it's really how the example that you set, the example that each one of us sets as an architect. And I think that essentially the practice of architecture is a social practice, and that it's an art form, but it's much more than that. And I think for the people who practice it as solely as an art form, they're missing a very, very important part of what architecture does, because essentially the way people live, the way people interact with their space, and the way the space is created or made, has a very deep, deep effect on how people interact with one another, how people feel about themselves, how people interact with their community. And it's just a much more far-reaching thing. I often go back to Nathaniel Kahn's film that he did about his father, called My Architect. I don't know how many of you have seen this documentary, but I encourage you to watch it. It's very interesting. Kahn was a very complicated man, but there is a moment when he's speaking to an architect in Bangladesh, and Kahn designed the capital city in Bangladesh, which came to its independence, and this was the first architectural manifestation of their democracy. And that is exactly what this architect says to Nathaniel. You don't understand what your father gave my country. He gave us democracy. And so architecture has a very deep, deep way of affecting all of us. And I think it's incumbent upon everybody who practices the profession to recognize that and to advance it as a cause.
I agree very much with what you're saying, and just how the forms that you make, like there is this aspect of, kind of enjoying the formal aspects of architecture, but at the same time, they register in real terms in people's lives. So every space that you make, should it be built, it will have nothing to do with you and everything to do with the people who occupy it, and they'll make it whatever it becomes. So, what you've done is still there, but the way that it's occupied, the way people use it, is really critical. So you must think about that aspect, that you're basically going to be producing this thing and then absenting yourself and, for maybe generations. I mean, that's really a wonderful thought, that for generations people would be using it and embodying it with their dreams and hopes and whatever actions, that take place in it.
So all this makes me think about what was said a minute ago about, I think the term was spatial injustice. So I started thinking, I'm listening to what you all were saying, and I'm Molly, what you're all saying and how this fits into this idea. And spatial injustice, I mean, can be lots of things. Spatial injustice can be how a building is designed to close people in or open people up, including people in what it looks like or not. I mean, spatial injustice could be, you said housing is a right, right? Democracy is design, housing is a right, spatial justice and injustice. That how you build communities, design communities and planning and architecture and city design so that people of mixed incomes live together? Or do you design things that are separate and how you design them? I mean, this idea of spatial justice is really, I think, important. I mean, whether it's the historical, from the historical view out to now and how we relate to that, because it's all connected. It's not separate. So this is an important concept. I mean, the idea of spatial justice. These folks, you are designing space of the future. You are the designers of the 21st century. It's going to be your baby, spatial justice.
It was interesting working on Roosevelt Island for as long as I did. So Roosevelt Island is a two-mile-long island in the middle of New York City that sits in the East River below the 59th Street Bridge, and it had has a long history. It was Blackwell's Island. There was a farm there, and then it was taken over by the city, and they built all kinds of institutions there. So it became what I called the Australia of New York. They just shoved everybody on that island they didn't want, right? So there was a lunatic asylum and a penitentiary and a detention house and all these people were surrounded by this water that has very swift currents, so you couldn't really swim off the island. You were stuck. And then in 1921, the city, most of the institutions had moved off that island, and the city reinvented it as welfare island, which in 1921 didn't have the pejorative meaning it has today. It meant for the well-being of, and they built these wonderful nursing facilities that were quite spectacular. One of them is being taken down for the Roosevelt for the Cornell University tech campus. But it's an incredible, the design, the plan of the hospital was so that every single room had natural light, and there were balconies that wrapped all the way around so everybody could go outside and enjoy these restorative island breezes. And then by the late 60s, the island was basically abandoned with the exception of these long-term nursing care facilities. And so Mayor Lindsay appointed a commission to study what should be done with this incredible piece of real estate in the middle of the city. And they came up with this idea that it should be a residential community. And at the time that they did it, it was considered really visionary because what they were planning was mixed income, mixed race, and an island that was fully accessible to the disabled. So they understood that the disabled really belonged on the island, that it was their island. They incorporated them into the design. And that, I think, is one of the most successful pieces of that plan. Anybody who has raised their child on Roosevelt Island, because the people in the wheelchairs just zip all around the island and they're integrated in the community. And it's one of the first times that people were starting to build residential housing for people with disabilities. And this was before graphic standards would say to you, you know, wheelchair needs a 36-inch door and a 5-foot radius. So they actually had to go and work with the people who were in the hospital, the ones that could live independently, to say, how do we design this for you? And so there was this incredible history of that as a social change on this island. And it's really amazing how much the attitude towards people with disabilities are different for people who were raised on that island, where they were part of just the community. They were part of the landscape. They weren't some unusual thing that people didn't see, you know. So I think that architecture can really affect enormous change, part of its responsibility.
Yeah, I'm still lingering on your the use of spatial justice, because New Orleans has been reflecting on this, the tension between what it means to have a kind of spatial equity in a city that is being transformed. And it's being transformed, obviously, out of this incredible tragedy and the influx of a new population, a more wealthy population, a wider population. And so, and they're settling into areas that traditionally they would not have. These communities have, you know, they were not places of regeneration. They were places of many, many generations. But now they are desirable. And so you're starting to see more amenities come. And for a while, those amenities are really welcome to the people who are there. And then at a certain point, there's a tipping point where it is so desirable that they get driven further away. And where they get driven away is less desirable places spatially, less convenient. So this is going on constantly as a place becomes desirable. So we really struggle because on one end, cities need to regenerate. Neighborhoods need to regenerate. If no one else is moving into your neighborhood, then you probably are living in a dead neighborhood. So this notion of regeneration is really important. And then the question is, how do you make it equitable? How do you take culture bearers, culture producers in New Orleans, which I was saying earlier, predominantly African American, they have created this incredible gumbo, and yet most of the culture is street based. You live kind of on the street, the second line, you know, parades and Mardi Gras. It's the front stoop, it's the porch. Even the institutions, the social framework, are like the corner store or the corner club. But they really are a kind of everyday architecture. So how do you begin to honor those as places that warrant preservation? We're constantly trying to get those who have influence to understand that those are the components of community as New Orleans knows it. And those are the places where reinvestment has to happen. But it's not the high architecture. It's the corner store. You know, it's the social club. And so it gets hard to talk about spatial equity or spatial justice when those kinds of components of your community are not perceived to be of value. And I think that's, so we end up advocating, you know, for the 200 teenagers that assemble under the interstate highway because they've created a skateboard park. And meanwhile, the recreation center, which is just next door, is empty. There are 200 teenagers vying to create social space. So we took them on at the Tulane City Center as our clients, as their advocates, helped them form a 501c3, took our students to help them build. They're doing a design build this semester where the architecture students are claiming that space for these young people and turning it into a public square, you know, with something like a $20,000 investment. So, you know, once again, it goes back a little bit to the point that these are spaces that are not honored. They are appropriated. They decided that this was going to be their park. And how do we as designers put ourselves in a position where we can help them formalize that, we can help them legitimize that? But all of these spaces, most of these spaces are kind of forgotten, on the fringe type of spaces. We, fortunately, because we kind of dream up things, we can look at an empty parking lot and see an incredible space or incredible building, we see some dignity in them. But not many, many other people who control capital see that. So I don't know. I think it's a very complex issue about, you know, spatial justice. But I think it gets at the very core of what we're talking about when we talk about publicness and public interest.
I just wanted to say that your skate park appropriation reminds me of something that happened recently out in Queens, where there was a group of elderly people who just sat in a McDonald's all day long, and they finally got into a fight with the McDonald's franchise because they were taking up their space but they had no place to go.
Community center, right?
If they were using it as a community center. Exactly. But I think that a lot of in the same way that there are laws made to punish people, there needs to be a set of laws that allow opportunities to take place so that communities can get involved in a process and not just a process that's about lip service where you're not really involved. But a lot of that has to come from the administrations on every level, the municipal level and everything. I mean, what's happening in New York City now is that, you know, it's this development machine, and it remains to be seen whether the new mayor is going to continue the Bloomberg development machine, or if he really is going to stand up, you know, for affordable housing and this, you know, to close the gap between what he called the tale of two cities. And I you know, it really has to do a lot with policies that need to be made and money that needs to be invested.
You can induce participation. You know, those of you who work in the profession have to deal with the public regulatory process. You have to deal with public hearings. Public hearings are legislated that means that there is that time, unfortunately, comes so late in the process that you can't really impact the outcome, but that is a requirement. So you could actually induce participation in the very earliest stages of a project.
Sometimes they don't want that.
I know. Right. And that's the tension that we're talking about. You know, we're talking about the need for the public to be able to learn new things and be able to use the process of something becoming as a learning process. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, government is about trying to get things done. Despite resistance by the general public, you know?
We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we continue this conversation about design and social practice with the Stella panel. Just a moment. Stay tuned. I'm talking with Maurice Cox from Tulane University in New Orleans, Yolanda Daniels from Studio Sumo in New York, and Gina Polera of the FDR Four Freedoms Park in New York, about design as social practice. This was a conversation hosted by Friends of Architecture at Morgan and the Morgan School of Architecture and Planning. And here's the rest of our conversation.
It's hard to separate these things that you're doing right now. I mean, you're not separating them, but they're putting these together because you can't separate out this idea of design as democracy and spatial justice and housing as a right and not interact with government and not interact with development. It's part of for want of a better term, whether it's Hegelian or Marxist, however you want to think about it, it's part of a dialectical struggle that people have because that's what exists, you know, constantly.
One of the other quotes that Thomas Jefferson had was he said, design and political thought are indivisible. And this is a president speaking. Design and political thought are indivisible. And he understood it from the formation of the University of Virginia and how he used that bricks and mortar to create a democratized space that still to this day has built-in friction, which he felt was necessary for the democratic process to thrive. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the difficult thing. You can't do without government, and yet we know that certainly in the past decades, government has abdicated a lot of its responsibility and outsourced it to the private sector, everything from your trash collection to God knows how many things. So, and that's been, you know, obviously there are people in this room who were around when actually government was an enabler, that people actually expected government to serve a social agenda. And designers, when they came out of school, expected to serve the public interest. There was a fantastic article by none other than, it was in the Wall Street Journal. It was an article, a very famous architect was being interviewed, and he talked about his coming out of school in the 1960s, that there was an expectation that he would serve a public purpose. And then reflecting on his career, he said, you know, well, the profession has abdicated its responsibility. We now serve the private interests. And as we have served more and more the private interests, we have become more and more irrelevant. The shock to me that this was Rem Koolhaas talking after he bought in to the system that made him an international star. And at the end of his career, he's saying, you know, I would have rather been that architect that served the public purpose. Now, I think, you know, he was on the cover of Italian GQ or something when he was saying this. But I thought it was a very poignant observation of someone who clearly understood that in order to succeed in the way that he has succeeded, he has served the public interest. He's been a part of not challenging the status quo. I mean, he certainly has challenged architectural thinking on many, many levels. But socially, he stepped right in line. You know, when China said, we want you to build this building, he stepped right in line. not thinking about the ethical challenge in front of him. So,
I mean, and I was thinking about, I had Paul Miller, DJ Spooky, on my show the other day, and we were talking about a bunch of things. We started talking about this concept about the 21st century being the remix century, and remix in a way that goes beyond music. I started thinking about this, we talked at lunch today about Baltimore City's history of painted screens. For those of you who don't know, Baltimore for years had painted screens. People in their row houses had screens that were painted. It was a whole culture that did them from 1911 and until into the 20th century, 21st century almost. And these screens were painted on the outside on mesh so that you couldn't see in, people could see out. It was done because houses were built together and people needed their privacy. And these houses were built to be affordable because these row houses in Baltimore were built so working class people could afford to buy the homes. And every neighborhood had, in a black neighborhood, you had Ideal Savings and Loan. And then you had the Bohemian neighborhood had their Czechoslovakian Savings and Loan. And everybody had their savings and loans that were all ethnically based back in the day in the early part of the 20th century in the city. So it meant that a working person with very little money could go into the savings and loan and go, okay, I want a house. And they would let you have the house. And every month they come and pay a little piece of the paycheck to the man. And in 30, 40 years, this little row house belonged to the people who lived in that row house with the little screens you couldn't look in, but they could look out. So remix, 21st century. We have to rebuild our cities. And we have to come up with ways these cities are affordable. One of the things your mayor has said, well, he'll do it or not, I don't know. We've been saying in Baltimore a long time, but nobody pays attention to us, is that he's going to require developers to take X percent of whatever they do to make sure they have housing that serves middle and working class and poor people to have affordable housing. How does that work? How do you make that work? To me, that's the remix of what happened in the early part of the 20th century. We got to do it now here because that's housing as a right. Yeah. That involves design as democracy. That is part of spatial justice. So what do you think? Yolanda, you want to start?
I keep thinking about, Gino, when you were talking about the senior citizens in McDonald's and the kind of altercation of that. And it's not just that McDonald's in Queens, but that's a condition that happens all over the country where senior citizens go to places like McDonald's or Hardee's or whatever where they can get a cup of coffee and kind of hang out. And it's an alternative to a senior center. And it seems like there's a design opportunity in that if one were to look at it, you know, carefully. And maybe, like, you know, you could survey those spaces and talk to the senior citizens who are involved, and you could actually come up with a program that you would then design around, you know, and work directly with them.
What I find so strange about that whole incident is that for the younger generations, we have a culture where, like, Starbucks encourages you to come and plug in your computer and drink a cup of coffee and hang out all day long. Is it because they're older, they don't get the same, you know, accommodation? I mean, I thought that's what was part of what struck me so funny about that situation was that, well, it's such a divide. I mean, why are these people being discriminated against because they're old? They want to hang out. They just don't have a computer. You know, they want to hang out and have a cup of coffee.
But I was also thinking of it in the context of the skaters and how you kind of, with your students, are working together to develop a space for them. And then also thinking about Starbucks and the way that people use it for either like the internet or public restrooms. Mm-hmm. And in New York, there is a kind of crisis where we don't have enough public restrooms and everybody knows you go to a Starbucks. And that's like a design problem. It's a social problem and a design problem. Right. It's a problem that the city hasn't addressed that in some ways, you know, a group could kind of take it as a rallying call the way that you've taken the skateboarders in, you know, a kind of illegal space as a rallying call to kind of do something about it. Mm-hmm. So it seems like maybe there are these instances that we're just not really recognizing, that people are telling us they need this type of space, for X social activity. But if we can find them, then there are design opportunities as well as social opportunities, opportunities for social change.
I came to Tulane largely because I was the bulk of my academic career has been at the University of Virginia. But I came to Tulane because something really special was happening there, because there was a collective project of rebuilding the city. It's attracting the kinds of students who are somewhat impatient. They want to affect change while they're in school, not after they're in school. And this project of rebuilding the city has given them the opportunity to have the city be a learning laboratory. And granted, there's a lot to learn, particularly with regard to how to enter a community and how to exit a community, how to listen to a community, but also how to find these opportunities. It reminds me of a project that two graduate students just recently completed, which was they found a vacant lot where men were throwing horseshoes. And it was, you know, they mowed the lawn, they played horseshoes, and they brought their grandchildren there. And their grandchildren would, like, run around on the field with these pieces of iron being thrown. And so the students said, you know, well, we think we could solve that. We could build a clubhouse, something that would be attractive for them to kind of observe the game. And so that was the students' way of looking at a problem that these men had, that the men just said that the kids are running around and it's dangerous. And the students came up with a solution. So they designed the clubhouse. They organized the labor force, meaning all of the men who played shoe horse were banging the nails and cutting the wood. The students didn't do any of the building. And then they used that as an invitation to have people talk about other spaces that they hadn't observed in their neighborhood. And by the end of the process, they had come up with a smart streetscape strategy. They responded to the immediate need of their client, you know, to keep kids off of the field. But they also opened up a conversation about the infrastructure of the neighborhood. They put it in a beautiful book, you know, graphically, very compelling, and left that with the community, who then took it to their political leaders, their city councilors, who then allocated hundreds of thousands of dollars to that neighborhood to improve the streetscape. And I just thought it was the kind of example of the entrepreneurial desire that students have today. When I was going through school, we wouldn't have assumed that we would go out and solve anything. You know, we basically were learning our craft within a very contained, controlled environment. I think, and I've watched this now for about 15 years, the generation that you are a part of has a much stronger social imperative. There's a kind of drive to, you know, change the world, and people are going out and doing it. You know, there are these conferences, whether it's Structures for Inclusion, whether it's, you know, Architecture for Humanity. There are all of these ways that the next generation of designers are effectively carving out a career in areas where traditional architectural firms didn't look for opportunities. And I think it's very encouraging. I see it, and now, as I said, now I'm at an institution where students come with that expectation, and it's very, very powerful. I know that must exist in a city like Baltimore, with the demands and the needs every time you step outside of your building.
Those who will define the 21st century, you have thoughts and questions?
Hello, my name is Chaz Janadu. I'm actually a civil engineering major here. We study in the same building. It kind of goes hand in hand with the architecture. Now, your discussion was very interesting when it came to the architectural viewpoint on what we can do with our society, but where do you feel that the engineers fall into this plan?
I think of the disciplines that affect the built environment as including civil engineers. I mean, we work with engineers, we're working with Engineers Without Borders right now to do a wetland garden and park in a part of New Orleans. And it's the Engineers Without Borders' first domestic project that they're tackling. We couldn't do this enormous, it has to do with stormwater management, project without the collaboration of engineers. So when I think of, I tend to use the word designers because I find it to be the most inclusive, you know, people who design objects, you know, people who design landscapes, preservationists, planners, urban designers, architects, the entire thing, and I would include engineers in that. And I think, you know, you might actually have, you know, a leg up because people value engineers, you know. you know, it's quantifiable, you know, it's, you know, people get it. And so I would just encourage you to kind of take the same message. I mean, if you can engage in as a citizen of your community and then bring those skills that you're learning to the problems that people are trying to solve, I think you're going to be incredibly successful.
Thank you.
It may be obvious to you all that your training brings you to a point where you can play these roles that you're talking about. But I was curious if you would just touch on a couple of the aspects or disciplines of a design education that do prepare you for that kind of new role.
I guess in my case, my education's been fundamental in opening my mind, exposing me, but also like teaching me how to channel questions into proposals, you know? Yeah, like the rigor that you learn in school, I found it very fundamental for my practice and for me defining, in a way, a unique practice to kind of look at social aspects. It shouldn't be unique, but it has seemed unique, at least right now. I think as more people do it, it's less unique. But the education was fundamental to being able to do that. So from the research aspects, definitely. Well, I felt an impetus to have a practice and to have the practice engaged with both the research and the practice. And I think that my engagement in educational institutions made that a kind of imperative for me, that it wasn't just practice. It was also trying to answer questions that went beyond the kind of pure form of the architectural project.
And the thoughts on this, Gina?
I think what I found about my architectural education, which was a second degree for me, is that it's so applicable to so many different realms. So I have a very eclectic background in that I do exhibition design and book publication and archival rescue missions and all kinds of things. But the kind of rigor that demand that architecture program demands of you, it really allows you, if you give yourself the opportunity, to apply it in so many different ways. I know a lot of architects who were trained as architects that went on to become something else, and I think that it's sort of fundamental to the education that you really are engaged in a process of thought, in the process of making, in the process of questioning yourself, of pulling something out of yourself, and engaging in the world. And I think that it just, all the aspects of the education are useful in so many different applications.
There's something fundamental after having the engineering student come up and speak. There's where there is a right answer, you know, in certain quantifiable disciplines. In architecture, every studio you take, let's say it's a studio of 12, there are 12 different answers to a single question. How bizarre. You know, for most people don't think that there are multiple equally compelling answers to a question that's posed. Architects do this year in and year out. And so I think it helps to create this notion that there are many, many possibilities. And most people, at least I know within a community, tend to think that there's a right answer, and they certainly don't think that there are multiple answers, and they certainly don't think to ask for multiple answers. But when an architect gets in the picture, they inherently ask for, well, what were the other alternatives to this development project that you left back on the table? A community would never think to ask that. So I think that that notion that there are multiple answers and ways to, and they can be equally compelling, is just kind of a fundamental fact of our education.
One more question.
My name is Deshaun Morris. I'm an architecture major. And I was listening, and I understand that you guys are talking about getting in touch with the community, and education is important to the whole process of making something that's more than about being just a building that's there for money, but it actually services the community the way that they want it to be serving the community, and that you need to do research in order to provide something that's actually has a function. And Ms. Yolanda said that law can show you how the changes have been made, and what I figured kind of that you can see what people wanted, and that's how laws were being created. So from seeing the laws, you can kind of see what they want, and from that you can help, it will help you to find out what you need to do to add to that community. But then I kind of, when you talk about developers are there for money, so developers have so much of an impact on the community, they could have just as much impact on politics and law. So can you tell exactly what people want from the law, because there might be the possibility that development or something else may have tainted that circumstance as to why the law was created. So how else could you tell whether it was based off of the community's want or based off of the developer's want?
Yolanda, why don't you start?
I'll try. I have a feeling Maurice will be better at answering this, but I think it's a combination of, like you're talking about, like competing interests, and they always exist. And so, and there are multiple kind of laws. You know, it's a complex field. So there are, like Maurice said, you know, the laws that dictate space, like zoning laws and, you know, the kind of regulations that give us the rules to build off of. And usually those are not rules that communities are, you know, actively engaged in. They come from the other direction, and developers are more involved in that arena. And in some ways, communities are maybe forced to be more reactive because they don't understand that arena. It's kind of in a professional realm that's not really part of the everyday. So I think as you were forming your question, it just kind of struck me, well, maybe we need to have some other kind of developer programs where developers are not developing for the market solely, but they're developing for communities, or they're developing for other interests and trying to figure out, you know, maybe the market isn't the key goal, or maybe it is the goal, but they're coming at it from a different way. So because there are developer programs, and it seems to me that the move in the developer programs that I've seen are to make them more architectural, but not necessarily to make them more social.
This is one of the learning processes of this community in the Lower Ninth Ward that I was talking about earlier, where they assumed that there was one kind of developer, and that is a for-profit developer that was driving these development to be high-rises. Through the process of engaging in this community workshops, they began to understand that there were nonprofit developers and who are driven by other factors, who actually value working with communities. And so the challenge was to get them to understand that, you know, not all developers are the same, that there are developers who work from the community, and that their organization, their ability to articulate a vision for what their neighborhood was actually going to attract those developers. And lo and behold, because of this activity, those developers came forward and are now actively engaged in supporting the community's vision for that site. Now, it started with a challenge to the law, you know, that the developers wanted to get a height variance in a neighborhood that has a maximum of 40 feet to 75 so that they could build their towers. Well, I think the process of going through multiple scenarios with this community helped them understand that they could actually have density within a 40-foot build-out. Again, it was a process of visualization. It was so they became very able to articulate, to be advocates for the appropriate kind of density within the existing envelope and the existing zoning. So I know. I mean, the laws. I certainly didn't know anything about this while I was in school. I mean, I learned this largely by trying to practice in a way that created community, and realizing that either you're fighting against laws that don't enable community, and in that case, you then have to become an advocate for changing the laws and changing the rules that can support community. So, I mean, I think it's a fantastic question and observation. And I'm glad we ventured into that that part of the of conversation.
Ruth?
I have something to say.
You do, I'm sure. Thank you for...
Thank you. That's what I have to say, because it's really been a very, it's been great. It's been really good. Really good. Very, very.
That was Maurice Cox of Tulane University in New Orleans, Yolanda Daniels from Studio Sumo in New York, and Gina Pallara of the FDR Four Freedoms Park in New York City. At the Morgan School of Architecture and Design last month, and I'd love to know what you thought about today's program. Please send us thoughts at steinershow@gmail.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at marylandeducators.org. That's one word, marylandeducators.org. Or you can go to steinershow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner. It's your thing. Do what you wanna do. I can't tell you who to talk to. It's your thing.